to the Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Wednesday, April 9th, 2014 will come to order. Senator Osmek, thank you for getting us here in a timely fashion.
But Senator Tomassoni, we don't have a quorum.
Well, we don't have a quorum yet, but they'll be here now that they know we started. So we have, what, six?
Or seven.
We need one more for a quorum. But Senator Scalzi, I think you can probably start the description of your bill, and you take your time because we don't have a quorum yet.
I'll take my time, but not too much time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If PCA gets controversial, then we'll even wait a little bit longer. So, go ahead.
This is my bill, Senate File Number 2193, and it's a bill proposed by the Minnesota PCA. It includes permits for permitting efficiencies and duty changes of the agency. And if you remember, in 2011, the executive order and permitting efficiency law directed PCA to improve their permitting timelines. And as we've gone through this process, we've gone through four committees, and we have worked with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and the MCEA and others as we've worked through the committee process. So I'll just go through the bill section by section if you have it in front of you. Section 1 is electronic submittal data, and that relates to the fact that somebody who's applying for a permit with the PCA could go through their permit process, and their information that they put on the web would be considered private until they click the word submit. So that it puts it on a level playing field with paper permits, which, of course, are private until you submit them by hand or in the mail. So that's what Section 1 does. Section 2 is permitting efficiency. It expedites the permitting process. It reduces the time, and it also creates a voluntary Section 3. Section 2 has the two permitting goals, 150 days and 90 days. So currently we only have 150 days. This adds a 90-day permit. And many of the permits that they grant are much shorter time frame than that. They could be 5 to 10 days. But this puts the 90-day goal into law. And it also consolidates the twice-a-year permitting efficiency into a once-a-year annual report. Section 3 is expediting costs for permitting, and defines...
Senator Scalzi, just a second. The quorum's present. Then, does this apply to all permits, or what permits does it not apply to?
Section 2 is DNR and PCA as well, right? And we'll have some testimony further that would have some DNR information on it as well.
Are these all permits? I mean, mining permits, water permits, everything?
Water, air, and land, Mr. Chair, that the PCA deals with, right?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it says environment and resource management permits. If you look on 1.19 to 1.20, that the environmental and natural and resource management permits be issued or denied within. So those aren't defined, but I think everybody knows what they are. It is water, mining, and everything.
Are there any permits that are not included here?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think it would be extended for DNR to bonus deer permits. I mean, things like that. They do issue permits, but I don't think anybody ever assumed that they would be extended to those.
What kind?
Like game and fish permits, permits for game and fish.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Mr. Senator Scalzi.
Okay. On to Section 3, Section 3 defines the assistance to applicants early in the process, and it defines the reimbursement process if applicants so choose to go that route. Section 4 and 13 create a 10-year non-federal water and soil permit, and I'll touch on Section 14 later, but currently in Section 4, at the bottom of page 6, it changes to a 10-year permit for non-federal water state disposal systems. That was 5 years. Federal permits are still required to be 5 years and can't be changed by state law. But non-federal permits in this bill were changing to 10 years for expedited efficiency and less cost to the applicant. Section 5 expands the current statutory authority for water quality trading. So if they're in the same watershed and someone is having trouble meeting their phosphorus goals, they can do some trading with someone else in the same watershed. For instance, the little town of Sacred Heart, 548 people, pays to consolidate and to trade some water permitting efficiency with Mankato because they're doing quite well on their water. Sacred Heart is not, and they would have to have a multi-million dollar upgrade to their wastewater facility. And Section 6, am I going too fast? Or
no.
Okay. Section.
Well, if she's going too fast, let her know, somebody. Okay.
Okay. Section 6 is deals with the septic tank fee payment system improvements. The septic tank fee permits are paid annually to the MPCA, and that funds the septic program. The fee is not changed, so the effort is revenue neutral. Section 7 is the MPCA permitting tiers and report consolidation. So here is where we define the 90 and 180-day permits. And did I say that? 150, I'm sorry. The 90 and the 150-day permits. The 150-day permits are those that require public comment periods. So there's a time built in there for public notice and comment periods, and they require individual actions. And then the 90-day permits is for all other permits. And in this section, we also consolidate the twice-a-year permitting efficiency report into an annual report so that it saves costs because you're doing it once a year rather than twice. Section 8 is the MPCA expedited permitting process, and that's purely voluntary. That allows the permit applicant that say they want more resources for a new type of action, they could pay to have an expedited process if they chose to have some extra help with their permit. Section 9 increases the availability of more time, efficient, and simpler administrative penalty orders. This is much like small claims court versus district court. The APO is easier for most people to do and rather than going through a larger court process, the stipulation agreement. And in here, I just want to interject that 90%, over 90% of permit holders are in compliance. So what we're dealing with in these small sections are people who are not compliant. And there's many ways that the PCA deals with people who are out of compliance with their permits. There's verbal notifications, inspection reports. These are all non-penalty areas. And in the penalty area, there's field citation, APOs, which we're dealing with here, administrative penalty orders, and consent decrees. So this is just the small portion of the app of the permit holders with MPCA would be dealt with these penalty orders. Section 10 defines the non-compliance and the SSTS violations. That's subsurface sewage treatment systems. And those are for professionals in business. We're not dealing with residents here. But a field citation is quicker action for more people, and there's more benefit to doing a field citation. So and the MOHA, which is the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association, is neutral on this proposal. Section 11, relating to these violations, it just defines the penalty amount that are defined in Section 10. And Section 12 deals with the Minnesota Business First Stop fee for service expansion, and it creates the option for the MPCA to charge a fee for service model for pre-application feasibility review of a concept. It could be used when an applicant is trying to determine if a new complex technology is even able to be permitted. And to date, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has not charged anyone for this type of service, but they are want to be prepared to respond to large requests. And I have with me here also today Kirk Kudelka from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and he will be here to answer any tough questions that you have after going through the bill.
Okay. Welcome, Kirk. Do you want to say introduce yourself and if you want to add on to what Senator Scalzi has said?
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kudelka, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I think Senator Scalzi did a very good job of describing the bill. I'm here to answer any types of questions that may arise. We do have one amendment to committee.
Oh, yes. Mr. Chair, we also have the A4 amendment.
The okay. It's in the packet.
I think you have
it's
in your packets.
It's in the packet.
Okay. If you don't, let me know. That amendment was, as I said before, we've been working with the Minnesota Chamber and with MCEA on this bill. And so this amendment answers some of their questions, and I'll let Mr. Kudelka explain this amendment.
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the changes in the amendment just highlight are starting on lines 1.17, starting with that first new sentence, and it goes through lines 1.23. There are three sentences added here. The first two are just some additional language to make sure there's protections in the case of trading between a point and a non-point. So a wastewater facility may trade with a shore bank stabilization project or some type of project done with, in conjunction with farmers. This just makes sure there are it's done in a proper way and that the trades are done in a ratio to ensure that what is being traded is actually realized, that environmental benefit. The last sentence, new sentence on line 1.23, was just to make it very clear that trades are voluntary. The two parties that enter the agreements, that it is a voluntary action. It's not that the agency will require one facility downstream from another facility to work into a trade with someone else. It is a voluntary action to initiate.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the one question I have in the amendment, and some of the language that's been added, it says the agency must require significant offset ratios. Okay, so what constitutes a significant offset ratio?
Mr. Kudelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, it will be done on a case-by-case. It's because there's a number of different types of projects that will qualify for non-point sources, and because there, it's much harder to make sure that you have the exact amount of reduction to be traded. When you're talking about two-point sources, wastewater facilities can have a good idea of what their actions are going to be in a reduction. In the case where we may be doing land management practices or the like, we have to build in some additional buffer there to make sure that we're getting an equal trade so that while the one source that is the one that's going over their permit is getting the equal or greater reduction from non-point source. So this language, significant, does mean there will have to be a ratio that's greater than 1-to-1, but it will be case-by-case specific. Anytime a trade's done, it will have to be worked out through permits. So there will be another public process, and the parties involved will all have opportunities before anything is finalized in any permits.
Okay, Senator Weber.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudelka, right now, I think we have allowance for offsets and other things. Is this a new offset, or is this just continuing on with the offset that was previously allowed?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, you're correct. There are some cases. Raw malting is one where we've allowed for trading. The entire section will allow for it in more cases. Right now it's restricted to nutrients. We'd like to expand that to other things such as sediment and other types of pollutants. The language also will allow for us to do it in more opportunities and times. Right now there's distinction on when it can be done, when it's a new or expanded discharge, but others may have other reasons that they may want to do for trading. So it, in the whole for the system, it expands it. Those few that are already trading, it would allow them access to that, but it doesn't change the conditions of their trades.
One more time.
Senator Weber.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess one last question. In the current trades that are allowed, do we base them, Mr. Kadelka, on a one-to-one basis, or are they based on significant offset or a greater than a one-to-one basis as well?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it is on a higher than a one-to-one trade for those point to non-point sources. There is a significant trade value there.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kadelka, I'm looking at the permit summary report from your agency here. We're looking at getting these permits turned around a lot quicker than we have in the past, and I appreciate that. But I'm wondering if 90 days is still a little high when I see you're getting permits out and at 52 in 5 days, some feedlots at 41, general permits at 18.5 days. I'm wondering why we wouldn't. And Senator Scalzi, I've not talked to you about this, but I'm just throwing this out for discussion. Why, at this point, why we wouldn't go to 60 days?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I believe the chart you're looking for is something that we hand out on a regular basis, and you mentioned average. And average means that while you may see 80 days there, that means that a good portion of our permits are above that number, and some are below it. So when we're looking at the 90-day goal or the 150-day goal, our efforts there is to get all the permits underneath those days. So even with those numbers that are on that chart, there are a number of them still not meeting the 90-day threshold because that is an average number. When we've looked at creating these two tiers of permitting goals, the 90-day for those that don't have public notice opportunities or others, the real benefit of the goal is for certainty for various folks, for us to be able to communicate with businesses that if you're getting this type of permit, it's in Tier 1, it's going to be 90 days, and you can expect that. If we start pushing down the date where that is, and we're starting to get where it's less often or even less than normal where you're meeting that goal, it ends up in a situation where the certainty is no longer there. The benefit of the goal is gone. To meet 60 days, as you suggested there, would create additional problems for permittees. Right now, those in the 90-day goal area would be an auto body shop or someone else that's at a small water state permit. They're usually not using contractors, so they're the ones filling out the applications and going through the process on their own. And a lot of times, there's a lot of additional information that's needed that would be requested by the agency. We want to have that opportunity to go back and forth with them. Well, at a 60-day goal, too, one of the big things that we find very helpful, especially with smaller permits and folks that aren't as familiar with the system, is being able to give back them the permit and look at it to make sure they understand what they're being asked to do after they supply the information. Having to meet a 60 days, that give and take back and forth with the applicant would have to be cut out. For us to meet the 60 days, we would end up doing more very carbon copy type permits and not be able to necessarily individualize them as much as we'd like for the permittee. In the end, I think we would have permittees asking more questions on why they're not given more time to get it the way they would like it best.
To follow up, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, how do you answer for the 5-day one when you're talking about feedlot? That's probably one of the more controversial ones, or one of the ones that take the most time. And your average is 41 days right now. The general ones are 18 and a half days. Individuals, yeah, the individual one is an 89. That's probably one over the top. But in general, feedlot general. Permitted SW facilities at 51. I mean, you seem to be way lower than 90 is what I'm saying. The AST permits at 43. So that's coming from your own report. So I'm wondering why 90 days. I mean, you tried to explain 90 days, but I'm just wondering, would the agency at all be open to a better goal? I mean, a better goal to serve those that are asking for permits at a 60 level.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the document you have is on an average. That's a different measuring system. we could try to – that would create a whole different goal system. We're not comparing apples and oranges on that document versus what we're comparing on the 90 days. What we're comparing on our 90 and 150 days is the percent that meet that 90 days or 150. When you're talking about an average, that means there's a number of them that are above that 80 days or that. And, yes, we do some permits within a couple days, but that's what's driving those other numbers down and hiding the fact that there are a number of permits that are up at the 80-day range.
Well, maybe to we'll go ahead, Senator Scully. You go ahead first.
Different subject.
Okay, so maybe to Senator Ingebretson's point is what determines that a permit will take 2 days or 90 days to be issued? I mean, there's obviously some factors involved here that some take longer than others. So what are the factors?
Mr. Chair and committee members, it really dictates on what the permit is. On our two-tier system, the first tier are created to be our simpler permits and our general permits. And we estimate 75% of our permits fit under that category. And so some of those are construction stormwater, where it's a very basic type of permit. And those are the ones we can get rolled together in 7 days. But once we start getting up to larger permits, some of our air permits where there might be more regulations or requirements of them, that's what really does drive the more time. And when we're starting to talk about those in the 150-day area, it's the public comment period. Public interest drives a lot of what we're looking at. Controversy, complexity, and public interest is what drives the length of the permit when we start getting into those upper 90 to 150-day time frames.
And Mr. Chair, and these are and Mr. Kodelka, these are goals, right? These are goals that the MPCA is shooting to get to, 90 days versus 150 days. So you would not like to see the goal to be 60 and exactly, and tell me exactly why not, when it's just simply a goal. I mean, it would just still — it would drive it home to the public that we are working with them. We're getting them out quicker. If you want to expand in my business, I'm going to find out earlier. That's all people are asking for.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we are doing that. Currently, it's 150 days across the board, and for 75% or so of the permits, we're moving that down to 90 days. We're looking to cut it 60 days. What we saw is after a little time with 150 days that we could do better. I think it would be good to see what we could do under the 90-day goal for these 75. And if we are having a huge amount that are making that, then maybe we can move down that goal. But at this point, I think we are making a big jump. We're cutting 60 days already for 75% of the permits on the goal. We also want the goals to be realistic. We, just like you were saying, a business wants to know that, you know, if I'm a Tier 1 permit, I'm going to get my permit in 90 days. But if we set an unrealistic goal, they may think they're getting it in – if we set it for 15 days, they may think they're getting it in 15 days, when we all know realistically they're not. So while a goal does help push us to where we want to be, we also have to have them be realistic so that businesses have the certainty that they demand when they're looking to locate in Minnesota and know what's coming up. That's what we hear from the business community over and over. They want certainty.
Okay. All right. I guess we have the A4 amendment in front of us. Is that what you want to act on, or do you want to comment on that, Senator Scully?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's what I was going to say. We started talking about the A4, and when we're done with this, then I would have an amendment on it.
Okay. Is there any questions or comments on the A4? It was explained while I was out of the room, so is it okay with everybody?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Senator Scalzi, did you move the A4?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, I would move the A4 amendment to 2193.
Okay. On the A4 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Opposed. Motion adopted. Okay. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi. I have some concerns with Section 9. And Section 9 is the provision in here that puts indexing on this APO penalty, the inflation adjustment. I have not been supportive of that mechanism very many times in my legislative career, and I'm going to make a motion to remove it here. But before I make the motion, I thought I would give you an opportunity to explain to me why in this situation it would be more important than in other areas. I think it's appropriate that the legislature come back and review these provisions. see what the impacts and what effectiveness they are, and if we wanted to change it, the legislature could change it. But I would not be supportive of putting an automatic inflation adjustment on the APO, and would give you a chance to respond.
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, and this amendment was added in, this provision was added in the Judiciary Committee, and it took about maybe half an hour, 45 minutes, and they approved this. So with that as a backstop, then I'll defer to Mr. Kudelka to explain why that's there.
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I just want to be clear what this provision doesn't do. It doesn't change a penalty amount. What it does is the tool that's used, the administrative penalty order, that process, and when we can use it. What happens over time is if inflation erodes when this can be used as things continue to move up, and it allows less and less people the opportunity to go into the simpler process. So it's not setting what a penalty amount or any expenses or cost based on inflation. What it's just doing is, can you get into the door into a simpler process of the APO versus a stipulation or a court action? So it's not putting government on autopilot. There's no expenditures or that's being driven by this. What it's just doing is making sure we're consistent, that everyone has 10 years, 20 years down the road, the same access to this simpler process.
Mr. Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Kudelka and Senator Scalzi. It does automatically adjust the maximum penalty, assuming upward. And I am not going to be supportive of it. Hopefully, Senator Scalzi, it doesn't take 45 minutes for us to resolve this. So I'm going to move that we delete Section 9.
Do we want to delete all of Section 9 or just the inflationary part?
I think that's all there is in Section 9.
Mr. Chair, if you look on 12.29, they are increasing the penalty from $10,000 to $20,000.
Okay, I would change my amendment to strike the new language on page 12, line 30, through page 12, line 34.
Anybody have any questions or comments? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, on the penalty increase, Senator Scalzi, can you what is that penalty exactly we're raising from 10 to 20,000? That's not in the amendment anymore, but I might consider
Mr. Goodell
taking the whole section out like Senator Skoy was originally thinking.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it may be helpful. I have a handout here. It's Chapter 115.071, which includes what the penalty amounts for the agency can be. We're not changing that area. So the maximum penalty, if this bill were to be enacted into law, would still be $10,000 per day per violation, or $25,000 per day per violation for hazardous waste, because it's in a different set. What we do when we go into a situation, we find something went wrong, we look at what happened, what was the potential damage, was there a history of it, was it willful, and we determine what the penalty dollar amount might be by a different section of law. If we come to the conclusion that looking at what this is historically compared to others, and a $15,000 penalty sounds reasonable for the action compared to all others, we then decide what tool we'd like to do. So this provision in the bill, what it does is it would allow for someone to use an administrative penalty order instead of going through the longer stipulation agreement process. It's all about what process we use, not the penalty amount, is what this changes. So in this case, a stipulation agreement usually takes from discovery to end 850-some days. An administrative penalty order usually takes from discovery to completion 256 days. And so what we're doing when this provision, the Senator, is allowing access, if someone were to be assessed a $15,000 penalty, to that simpler process where they have to spend less time away from their job dealing with the MPCA to rectify it, or they have to spend less time hiring an attorney and the attorney fees that may be captured in that, and the environment benefits, because we bring it to a closure much quicker. I just want to note this is not changing the maximum penalties, because that's in a separate section of statute with the handout I just sent, and that will not change by the passage of this bill.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kudelka, what you just explained seemed to be opposite to me, but did I misunderstand? You said the stipulation process takes 800 and some days, and the other administrative process is 250 or thereabouts?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, you're correct. The stipulation process does take a much longer time than the APO.
Mr. Kudelka, I mean, why is that? I mean, the administrative process is more legal, more of a structured legal process. Typically, the stipulation, in my experience, is more where the agency is willing to negotiate with the entity or the person. That just doesn't even make sense to me. What am I missing? Why? I mean, the administrative process is basically the legal process, and if you go through the administrative law hearing and don't like the outcome, you can appeal it to a district or appellate court. I mean, that is riddled with lots of attorneys as well. Where's the disconnect?
Welcome. Just say your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the Smith, I'm the director of the Industrial Division. So a little bit about each of those tools. One, a stipulation agreement is a negotiated settlement.
Mr. Smith, 1 second.
Could we contain the discussion to my amendment, which deals with the inflator on the maximum penalty amount, not on the change from 10,000 to 20,000?
I think Senator Westrum was considering amending your amendment, including the 20,000. So let's see if we can get is that correct?
That is where I was concerned, Mr. Chair, but I understand Senator Scoy's concern. But maybe we can address it here with Mr. Smith.
And okay, Mr. Smith.
Not belabor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So the administrative penalty order is addresses the violations and assigns a corrective action. They'll submit a penalty payment and do the corrective actions within 30 days. That's part of the requirements of an APO, that the resolution of the noncompliance happens within 30 days. That is a very quick tool when the violations are clear-cut, and it's helpful for the regulated parties if they want to get this thing done quickly. Right now, our authority on the APO is only $10,000. We can't go above a $10,000 maximum. A stipulation agreement is a negotiated settlement and is more appropriate when the corrective actions to resolve the noncompliance, like they have to, let's imagine the regulated party has to build something. They have to put in, build a brand new stabilization pond or add a piece of control equipment. That'll take longer than 30 days to correct. Then the stipulation agreement is a better tool because not only will we negotiate the penalty, but we'll give them a longer bit of time to work on the corrective actions themselves. What we're trying to do here is raise the APO level to $20,000 because we are discovering now through time that $10,000 area between $10,000 and $20,000 allows people to resolve noncompliance because they don't want to negotiate longer-term settlements, nor do they need to because the corrective actions can be done quickly. So this allows more flexibility for the agency. It also allows more flexibility for the regulated parties that are subject to the enforcement action. Oftentimes, a stipulation agreement requires that the regulated parties hire attorneys and consultants, and sometimes that's appropriate. But sometimes if the violations are clear-cut, it's a reporting violation or a series of reporting violations, they want to just pay the penalty and be done with the action and move on to other sorts of business.
Mr. Smith, just to wrap this up, so this provision, if we pass the Scoy Amendment, it doesn't affect raising it to 20,000, but it also doesn't put it on autopilot, so we don't keep raising that $20,000 threshold until you come back to the legislature, if I understand it right. Is that correct?
That's
Mr.
correct.
Chair, committee members, that's how I understood the suggested amendment.
Okay. All right. Thanks. All right. So on Senator Scoy's amendment, which I happen to agree with, I think it's a good idea. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion is adopted. Are we done with the bill, or have you explained it all, or is there more to explain?
Mr. Chair, I think we have explained the bill, and the amendment was the most discussion. There wasn't much on the bill itself, so I believe that we're ready to go.
Senator Westrum.
If Mr. Smith could answer, or Chair Senator Scalzi. So we're raising under Article 9, raising the penalty. What is the reason? Is it just that over 20 years your penalties have landed more in the 10 to 20,000 range than less than 10,000 because of inflation? Your penalties are getting bigger? Or what's the reason we want to raise that threshold? I understand raising it allows more regulated parties to fall into it, but are we just raising the threshold because you want to get bigger penalties of people, or have they just naturally increased?
Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chair, committee members, again, we're not raising the penalties at all. Imagine that we went through a penalty calculation, and the penalty calculation turned out to be $15,000. We added up all the violations. Let's say there's a series of reporting violations plus noncompliance. The penalty is $15,000.
Smith, here's my question.
Yes.
That $15,000 calculation, 10 years ago, would have it been $15,000, or would have it been $10,000 or some other number?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, it would have still been $15,000. Our penalty scale has not changed.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any further discussion on Senate File 2193, Senator Scalzi?
I apologize, Mr. Smith, but that just doesn't make any sense to me. What's the point of raising the maximum penalty from $10,000 to $20,000 if you could have a $15,000 penalty prior to this change?
Mr. Smith, try again.
Mr. Chair, committee members, so let's go back to my example. If we had a $15,000 calculated penalty, under our proposal, we would have more flexibility if it's a violation that needs to be resolved or could be resolved quickly, which is always the intent, often the intent of the regulated parties. This would allow us to use either of the tools, either an APO or a stipulation agreement. Again, if the noncompliance is going to take longer than 30 days, then we will want to use a stipulation agreement. If it's something that we want to resolve quickly, as does the regulated party, then we can use the APO tool. In the past, we could not use that.
I understand. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any further comments or questions on Senate File 2193 as amended? Anybody in the audience need to say anything on this bill? Okay. All right. Seeing no further discussion, then Senator Scalzi moves Senate File 2193 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the full Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you very much. Senator Herr. Did he say quickly?
Yeah.
Yeah, he can do it quickly. Okay. All right.
Oh, I was trying to do this. I'm going to vote
close. Mr. Chair and community member, thank you. Thank you very much. Senate File 2186 is an unemployment insurance bill. It's a housekeeping bill for the 2014, and the provision in the bill has been discussed and composed by diverse representative of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council and received consensus from DEED. It was heard in the Policy Environment Committee, and due to a small fiscal note, it referred to this committee. This bill has two parts. Article 1 mainly state the policy, and Article 2 may change to simplify the bill for easy understanding for businesses and individuals. It also made modification to reduce interest rate on unemployment insurance-related debt. So with me to explain this bill in detail and answer any question that committee member may have is Rick Calleri and Craig Gustafson from Department of Economic Development.
Mr. Calleri, you want to go first or who wants to go first? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Calleri. I'm the director of the Unemployment Insurance Division at DEED. Again, as the Senator Herr explained, this did go through a vetting process through the UI Advisory Committee. That committee does consist of business representatives, labor representatives, diverse representatives that are interested in public policy related to unemployment insurance. And it did receive a consensus to go forward from that group and then was approved by the governor, of course. The major thing that's going on in this bill, there are a number of housekeeping provisions, but the major policy change here is that we're seeking to lower the rate, the interest rate that we charge to both businesses and applicants. In the case of businesses, it would be businesses that do not file and pay interest on the penalties we assign for that. And in the case of applicants, it's for applicant fraud. And those would be applicants who knowingly request unemployment insurance benefits when they're not eligible, and then they get caught, and we assess penalty. For years, since 1982, I believe, that interest rate has been 18%. And that was set back in 82. The interest rates were screamingly high. Prior to that, it had been 12% for about 30 years. And 12% is kind of the average interest rate charged for fraud overpayments. As you look across the country, there are more states that charge that amount of the states that charge interest. That's a common interest rate charge for fraud overpayments. The reason we're seeking to lower this is that we do catch folks when they're overpaid, and we have various means to collect from them, including getting their tax returns, et cetera. And there are a significant number of folks that legitimately try to pay their way out. And 18% is pretty onerous. The interest rate does need to be high enough to induce people to pay us back. If they erroneously got unemployment benefits, they need to pay us back. If the interest rate is too low, your return rates are lower. And we are under significant pressure from the federal government to get a certain percent of overpayments paid back. But so we think that the 12% is a reasonable rate, and that's the major policy provision in this bill. Mr. Gustafson can go through the other particulars in the bill.
I thought we did that last year. What happened to that?
Mr. Chair, members, we did it last year, and I can't tell you the reasons, but for some reason everything fell out of the bill last year, and we were told only what we absolutely had to have.
Okay. All right. Mr. Mueller, you have a go ahead and tell us what.
Mr. Chairman, there is a fiscal note in your packets for this 2186, and on the third page of the fiscal note under assumptions, it lists, you can see the changes in the interest rates for, and those two changes are contained in Section 3 and Section 6 of the bill, and this would, those two sections together would reduce the money going into the unemployment insurance account by $1.2 million. And this is a non-general fund account, and this would start in fiscal year 16. And I think the department has said there's usually surpluses in this account anyways, and so that reducing this revenue shouldn't have an effect on any expenses.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Minnesota's UI Trust Fund, which is a trust, it's a federal trust fund, but each state has their own account under the fund. So we get the taxes from employers, and it goes into this trust fund account, and that's what pays for unemployment insurance benefits. There are still 20 states that are in debt as a result of the Great Recession. At the close of March, Minnesota's trust fund was at $1 billion. So we have a very, very healthy trust fund.
I think this is a good thing, actually. So, Senator Scoia.
Mr. Chair, with all that good news, maybe you could lower the UI rates.
We did, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoia, we did. There was a tax decrease this year of $295 million. So I know you and I have spoken in the past about a maximum experience rate employers and their tax rates. The average maximum experience employer got a tax decrease this year of approximately $249 per employee.
Okay. Yep. Senator Westrom.
What percentage of a rate did that equate to? I mean, a lot of employers. Do you know offhand? I mean, is that a half a percent, a quarter percent?
I don't, Mr. Chair, representatives, I don't have a calculation of percentages. Again, most of the tax cut happens this year because the base rate went down to the minimum amount, and then the special assessment went away completely. So there was $295 million savings to employers this year, and then there'll be another $61 million next year.
So back to a question, Mr. Chair. You talked about the fraud. What percentage do you experience of fraudulent overpayments? Of the payments that go out, what percentage are you talking?
Mr. Chair, members, I do not have that percentage with me. It's been constant for about 40 years.
40.
It stays constant. That percentage doesn't, and it's the primary situation where people get overpaid is for whatever reasons they go back to work and they continue to request benefits for a period of time until we catch them.
So any idea? I mean, 1%, 10%?
I don't have that with me.
We can get that, though, right?
We can get that.
You can follow that up.
Okay. Yes.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Gustafson, if I remember our discussions, and the ones I was at least, this bill is pretty well vetted and not very controversial, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Craig Gustafson, Director of Appeals and Legal Affairs with Deed. I'd say that's correct. It was well vetted by the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council. And there wasn't significant opposition in the advisory council to any of the provisions that are included in the bill that you see before you today.
Do you want to highlight something so people know what's in here besides the reduction in the interest rate?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Article 1 are the policy provisions that were recommended by the advisory council. Those are include seven sections, including those two interest rate reduction provisions that Mr. Caligiuri already discussed. Other sections include a change in the standard of ownership for employer experience rating history transfers, a clarification of severance pay as it affects eligibility for benefits, an exemption for attorneys from certain types of online filing requirements, and the exclusion of non-qualified stock options from counting as wages when exercised by a former employee. Article 2 includes the 26 sections that are considered to be housekeeping changes. These sections simply eliminate unnecessary language, make the statute easier to read and understand. Several of those sections are included to improve the organization of the statute and to repeal unnecessary and outdated statutes and administrative rules. Be happy to answer any other questions that the chair or members would have.
Anybody have any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, then Senator Herr moves Senate File 2186. Be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion adopted. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Senator Herr, you have the last bonding bill of the session.
The last.
All right. Let's get one. Yeah, let's get going. I got a water tower I need.
Get the water tower.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Chair and Committee, the better
1808
is our Senate next Senate file here. The Battle Creek Regional Party is about 2 miles, you know, line of sight from here. You can see the out, and you can see the capital from the Battle Creek Regional Park as well. It consists of at least 1,800 acres of natural area composed of wetland, grassland, and woods, and it's home for various wildlife, attracts recreation of all sorts, including cross-country skiing and other winter activities. And Senate File 1808 is asking for bonding appropriation of $2 million with an equal match from local and private sources to install snow machines so that on a dry year we'll get more visitors to the east side of St. Paul. This project will increase tourism to the area and generate economic development. So I have three testifiers, and with me is Greg Mack, Director of Ramsey County Park and Rec, and Ramsey County Commissioner Jim McDonough, and also Mark Holy, board president of Endurance United. I think it's a ski enthusiast group.
Okay. Whoever wants to go first, just say your name for the record and then go on with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Greg Mack. I'm director of Parks and Recreation for Ramsey County. Also, I just want to introduce Commissioner Jim McDonough, who is here in the crowd. He's the chair of the county board and is the county board member that's in that district where Battle Creek is located. Interesting that we're here on the warmest day of the year talking about snowmaking. Everybody's probably a little tired of snow these days. We love snow when it's usable, and cross-country skiing is a passion of a number of our constituents. For the last three or four bonding sessions, we have appeared before the various committees requesting funding for this project. It is to provide consistent snowmaking on this very, very cherished area on the east side of St. Paul for cross-country skiing. The proposal would do 2.5 kilometers of trail. It would allow us to provide snow at very marginal conditions. So if it's 20 degrees, we can provide snow on that area. This year we did a pilot project, pretty labor-intensive, brought in one snow machine and a lot of people to make snow. We were successful. You may have noticed that there was snow around the whole metropolitan area as a result of that. But it is something that allowed us to actually demonstrate that with consistent snow, we could book events.
Are you responsible for the potholes, too?
No. Okay. No. That's the potholes are somebody else's. They own those. But the two pages of a handout that you have illustrate what we would do with that funding. The appropriation, if approved, would put an in-ground system of steel pipe and electrical service in order to have snowmaking throughout the 2.5 kilometers. It does illustrate on the first page that yellow line, it would be that 2.5 kilometers. Throughout the park, though, there's additional, another 15 kilometers of cross-country ski trails. The second page is a little more detail of how pipes would be laid, but the red portion on the second page illustrates the 1.1 kilometer trail that we did as a demonstration. As a state resource, cross-country skiing in the metropolitan area provides the stimulation to get people outdoors, and it allows for people to go not only from the metro in the metro area to ski, but those weekends and those journeys that they take to the other parts of the state of Minnesota. We've worked with a broad coalition of people, all supporting one another's venues to really make Minnesota and claim Minnesota as the number one Nordic ski destination. So with that, there's a couple of people with us. We have a little change of individuals from what the senator indicated. We have Chris Sachs, who is the executive director for Endurance. It's a citizen group that supports cross-country ski efforts. And then we have a coach from one of our high school teams.
Welcome. You just say your name for the record and then go ahead.
Will do. My name is Chris Sachs. I'm the executive director of Endurance United. Endurance United is a nonprofit organization based in St. Paul, focused on creating opportunities for active, healthy enjoyment in the outdoors. And Nordic skiing is one of our areas of focus. We also do trail running and other things of that nature. So we have contact with a few thousand people over the course of the year. So I'm here as a community representative. You know, we put on athletic programming for the community at large. And in the winter, when, you know, we're based on the east side of the Twin Cities, there's many high school teams, many families, many young children that we teach learn to ski programs, adults that we teach learn to ski programs. And, you know, we see this as not only a benefit to this region, but as Greg mentioned, to the state of Minnesota, because as we work with these high school teams and families and athletes, they are involved in this activity. And with their free time, which is something that kind of speaks to the soul of the state of Minnesota, you know, they travel around the state to enjoy this activity in the northern woods. Giants Ridge is a big destination. The North Shore is a big destination. And many of our, you know, members enjoy this activity. And so we actively seek out to incorporate new people so that, you know, they enjoy this activity, they learn, they grow, and they participate in winter activities and stay healthy. And so that is our primary goal, and having a facility of this nature would be a big benefit to the community, the health, and to the state of Minnesota. I don't know if there's any questions for us, but otherwise, I'll pass it back to you.
Any questions of either of these witnesses? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know that in 2013 you qualified for some legacy funding for this project?
You're a wonderful individual.
It's bringing back some memories to me.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we did not. There was some cross-country ski activity at the Three Rivers Park District in 2013. That would have been a project that they were working on at Highland Lake Park Reserve.
So you didn't. So, Mr. Chair, you didn't qualify for a grant, Ramsey County grant at all then?
Chairman, Senator, the only grants that we receive is the local grant and aid program through the Department of Natural Resources. We do get grants for grooming. That's about $14,000 a year, but not a capital project grant.
Thanks.
All right. Welcome. Say your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Rob Loggison. I'm a St. Paul resident, grew up in St. Paul. I'm a lifelong skier, and currently I guess my expertise here is that I'm head Nordic ski coach at St. Paul Central, and I've been the head Nordic ski coach for 11 years now, been associated with the program for 16 years. We are asking for snow at Battle Creek because it would be a big benefit to our program and to the other high school programs in the area. There are three other man-made snow venues for Nordic skiing, but they are all on the other side of Minneapolis, and it's very hard and expensive for us to get there. So having something on the east side would be very beneficial. Last year I had 82 athletes on my team, boys and girls. There are 4,000 high school skiers in Minnesota, and the majority of those are in the metro area, and there's a large portion of that are in the east metro that would benefit from having snow at Battle Creek. Having snow early and consistent and dependable is really important to having a dependable program. You know, we have athletes that come out in the middle of November. If we have to make them run until January, we lose quite a few of them. So they come to ski, and if we can have snow for them, that would be great. We have a really strong high school program. We have really strong masters and adult programs. There are hundreds of elementary school kids that are learning to ski both at Battle Creek and at Como Park, just on the east side. So there's more in the pipeline. So we would really benefit from this. I think it's a great thing for the community as well as for the state. So thanks for considering it.
Thank you very much. You know, we love it when you come up to Giants Ridge, too, you know.
We love to ski there, and we go up there twice a year as a team, or we have pretty consistently. The Mesabi Invitational is the largest high school ski race in the U.S., 1,300 high school skiers in one day.
Wow.
And then we usually try to make the state meet, at least individuals, but my boys' team have been there three out of the last 5 years. So.
Good to hear. Senator Saxhart.
And sir, have you ever skied at Mount Itasca?
Yes. Mount Itasca is a great place to ski, and we've actually taken advantage of skiing there in years when we haven't had snow because of the man-made snow. It's a great biathlon venue.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Senator Herr, any final comments?
Well, I think this project will be a great benefit to the district, not just community development, getting young people, you know, involved in skiing and learning skiing, but also promote economic development. Eastside could be a destination site again due to a loss of major businesses, and the only thing left is small business with lots of restaurants. And if we can attract tourists to our district, those folk can eat at the restaurant as well. So I see the economic benefit of it.
Do you have any cousins that own any of the restaurants or anything? Or?
Plenty. A lot of them.
He does on University Avenue, I know.
Okay. With that, then we'll lay Senate File 1808 over for inclusion and a recommendation to the bonding committee. So thank you all very much for coming. I appreciate it. Good
project. Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Schmidt, how are you feeling?
Like a million bucks.
Senator Schmidt, I don't know if you were watching the proceedings from home when we did the bill the last time, but we got to the point where we were recessed and there was an amendment proposed by Senator Saxog to delete Section 49, and we've had some extensive discussion on the length of the muskie. I don't know if there's more comments or questions on it before we act on the amendment, but if anybody would like to make comments on it, I'm more than happy to entertain questions or comments. Senator Ingebretson.
Mr. Chair, if the DNR would be so kind to come up, we are having a little dialogue with them as well with regards to the management plan of the muskie. And I guess I'm interested. There was testimony Monday about the management area, the DNR with Muskie, was talking about potentially allowing larger than even what we're talking about Muskie on some particular lakes. Can you give me or shine a little light on the subject as to what lakes they are and how many there are that we're willing to go? I believe it was 61 inches.
56.
Oh, sorry, 56 inches.
Boy,
61, I was a little over the top, yeah. 56. I knew it was larger than what we were talking about.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, Ed Bogus, Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources, and I didn't hear all the testimony on Monday, so I'll try not to repeat things that Mr. Pereira might have said. He had another meeting out of town today, so he couldn't be here. But generally, right now we have a rulemaking that's in progress that would reset a statewide minimum muskie size from the current 48 inches to 50. We're talking about a two-tiered approach. There's about 100 muskellunge lakes in the state right now. We think there's a couple dozen of those lakes that could support produce basically a large trophy muskie and support a higher limit of maybe 56 inches. We don't have, or at least I haven't seen that list of which lakes those are at this point, so I'm afraid I can't give you that level of detail today. But we're talking about approximately a fourth of the total muskie lakes in the state.
So there could be more, could be less than 24. Is it?
Mr. Chair, it could be more or less. We would do a lake by lake kind of assessment. We have in the metropolitan area here a number of lakes that are crossed between muskellunge and northern pike, commonly known as tiger muskies. They don't get as big as what we're talking about here. So, but in some of the large lakes in the state where we have the capacity to produce very large muskellunge, you know, Leech, Mille Lacs, Winnie, places like that would be the types of lakes we'd be looking at for the larger limit.
Senator Saxon.
And, Mr. Chair, you know, the reason that I made the amendment was that I think it's important that, particularly in this case where the DNR, by rule, is working on their own on their own rules, that we don't start making our own laws that function as telling the DNR what to do in terms of wildlife management. And we have a lot of wildlife biologists that we employ, and I think we ought to let them do their job.
Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair and members, back in the 40s and the 50s, you could fish muskies anytime, as many as you wanted. And so there's many pictures out there that they would go up to Leech Lake and they would just slaughter the muskies, and there's big stringers of muskies. And then in 1956, they said, well, you can have one daily. And so then they all but vanished from the upper Midwest. They were gone. They weren't something that you could fish anymore. But early on, Hugh Becker, who was a member of the Muskies, Inc., he decided to do something. Now, he's a private organization, and he really made an impact. This is a private organization. And he started tagging and releasing and documenting and writing down the evidence of what was happening with the muskies, not the DNR, but a private individual with Muskie, Inc. And so he documented that the growth and the evidence proved that catch and release worked. And so he convinced the DNR, private individual, convinced the DNR in 1970, and he worked with them so that they could understand that catch and release worked. So I think we've seen overall that Muskies, Inc. in the private sector has really worked on this issue and really has the expertise. And, you know, in 1980, the length was 36. In 1993, the length was 40 inches. And in 2007, it went to 48. So it's not unprecedented to go to 55 because the numbers have been progressing in that manner. And I would tell you that they've shown that the fishing pressure of in 1991 was 31,000 fishermen. That's who fish muskies. And right now that pressure is 110,000 in 2013. So I think we need to do something now. We need to protect these this fishery that we've really worked hard to produce these trophy fishes. And I don't think I want to wait until the DNR does a lake-by-lake study and lose this whole class of fish. They have been growing these monster fish for 25 years, and we could take them out in a short matter of time. So I would really not support Senator Saxog's amendment.
Senator Scoyce.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess kind of to Senator Root's point, but there are some lakes that have these tiger muskel eggs where fish just don't grow that big. So, in effect, you have 100% catch and release. Nobody ever takes a large.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Hang on 1 second. Senator Scoyce talking.
Seems to me that the department is making progress here. And I don't know what kind of time frame, and maybe Mr. Bogus can help us with that, what kind of time frame they're under to get these lakes to the 56-inch criteria that they were talking about. But I certainly wouldn't like to see some of these lakes where the fish just aren't going to get that big be included in the 55-inch category.
Senator Schmidt.
To Senator, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Scoy's point, maybe what we could do is we could offer up an oral amendment here, and I know that there are tiger muskies in the 7-county metropolitan area that tend not to get much bigger than 40 inches, and maybe what we could do is set that limit at 40 inches for the tiger muskies in the 7-county metro area, and I'm not sure if that goes far enough for you, Senator Scoy, but I'd be happy to entertain that.
Well, it's in my understanding that's what the rule is right now in the 7-county metro area. It's 40 inches.
Well, but exactly. We'd carve
question,
out this.
The question is if this Section 49 turns all those lakes into 55 inches also. And I don't know if it does or not, so I don't know the answer to that. Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, flip it back. Right. Not being one to always view the DNR in 100% positive light, I find it surprising that I'm going to say that we probably ought to let their process work in this situation. It seems to me that they're where they're heading is exactly where we want to go with the, you know, they're going to have these lower level lakes. They're going to have some middle level lakes. They're talking about 20 to 24 lakes potentially with a 56 inch limit. It seems pretty reasonable to me.
Okay.
But you'd be supportive of what Senator Sackstock
right.
is trying to do.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to belabor the point, but we at this Capitol, many times we overrule the DNR. And I think most recently we did it with the wolf season. That was a legislative intent to have a wolf hunt season. DNR did not propose that. That was a legislative intent. And I don't, you know, we do occasionally overrule the DNR or change the DNR. And I've watched what they've been doing on Mille Lacs. I do not think they are doing the right thing. This is my own personal opinion. It's nothing else other than that. But I think that they have not done a good job with that lake. And I think that if the private sector has done a lot of work on this issue, I think we should listen to them. I listen regularly to the people who work with Muskies, Inc. and with the fish, and I think that they've done a good job. It's their whole life to a lot of people, this issue.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm somewhat confused on that, on Senator Scalzi's information with regards to the gray wolf hunt, and I certainly don't want to open that up here today.
No, we don't want to do that.
I do know that the DNR was prepared, had been prepared for when and if the gray wolf came off the endangered species list, which it did, I want to say 2.5 years ago, and they were prepared to actually manage the animal, and that was the decision of the legislature with, by the way, the support of the administration and the commissioner at that time, which are the same. So I'm not sure I remember it that way. But yes, we do, in fact, sometimes pass laws that direct the DNR to do different things in what they're doing. And sometimes they're social issues, and we each get involved in them because of constituents that pressure us. And I get that. I understand that. But Senator Saxog's right. We do employ an awful lot of people that do the science, and not to degrade the science of Muskies, Inc. I'm not here to do that. And you know, there are some people out there that are doing their own thing. So where I was going to go with this was, Senator, Mr. Bogus, you have restrictive lakes for various species of fish, and northern pike being one of them. And I know, over the years, you'd had restricted, and the thought was, I think, at that time was to grow the pike, and over the last couple of years, you've loosened up those restrictions because the pike have grown to be as big as they can in those lakes, I'm assuming. Is that fair and accurate?
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I didn't quite catch all the question, but what we call special and experimental regulations that are lake-specific, and we do adjust those based on what the response is. And so we have, like, if it's a length limit for northern pike, if we're not seeing the results, we either drop those or we change the length. And so we do adjust based on the response that we see from the fishery. We base the proposed regulation on what we think is going to happen, but then it takes fish are slow growing, and it takes, you know, 10 or 20 years to get results on some of these regulations, but we do adjust them then based on the actual outcome over time.
And follow up, Mr. Chair and Mr. Bogus, we had extensive talks over the last couple of years with regards to the illegal taking of a muskie and what the sanctions are. Not only do you get a criminal sanction, but you also have a civil sanction. Is that right? What happens to somebody that takes one? And by the way, there was only one taken, I think, by spearing at least, and maybe, I don't remember, the numbers were really low that were taking over the limit size of muskie. But they have a large price tag. The DNR's got a large price tag on the taking of a muskie in this state. So this breed of fish has gotten a lot of attention from the legislature. My point is, we've really paid a lot of attention, not only the DNR, but I think the legislature with regards to that. I mean, we take it very serious. If you take one of these out of season, or you take one that isn't of the correct length, what is the fine on a fish that's taken that's under the limit? 47-inch muskie.
Mr. Bogus.
It's significant.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I was looking to Major Meyer, who's here, and I'm not. There is a. You're correct. There's a there's a criminal fine and there's also a restitution amount, and I can't recall off the top of my head what that restitution amount is, but it's a significant additional cost to the person that takes them illegally.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Bogus, we have those on special species in this state. Is that fair to say?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, we actually have restitution values established for pretty much any protected species, but they are much higher for what you might classify as, you know, special species or, you know, endangered species or, you know, larger species. I can't recall the specifics on muskellunge.
Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it possible if, you know, we're to Senator Skoy's amendment, which I happen to support, is it possible that if we directed you inside this legislation with an amendment to say you will have the regulations ready by April 1st, 2015, do you think that the DNR can perform the function of putting these rules together and having them in place for the next fishing season? Because ultimately, I agree that some of these lakes should go to the higher limit, but I also agree that we shouldn't just wait around for the DNR to decide if and when they particularly choose to do something. Do you think that that would be something that the DNR could accomplish before, from one year from today?
Mr. Logan.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, we have an exempt rulemaking process under the special and experimental statutes. It's a pretty prescriptive process. So the short answer to your question is I think it would be difficult to do it within 1 year. The process that we follow is to post the lakes where we're proposing to do this. We typically want to do that prior to the opener. They have to be posted, I believe, for 90 days. Then we have to have public meetings, hearings, take public comment, and then promulgate the rules after that. So it typically takes a year. We have not identified the lakes yet this year. It would be difficult to identify those lakes and get them posted prior to the opener, which is what it would take to get it done within a year. So it's probably theoretically possible that it could be done that quickly, but not likely. And actually, Senator Schmidt was just asking me a question on the side here about how we do this two-tier process and what we would have to go through and could we, in fact, get it done. And you know, there's a little bit of unpredictability in that because we're posting these areas, we're taking comment, and then we're deciding what to do. So part of that, because this is more about kind of the social aspects of fishing and what do anglers want on these bodies of water, you know, in terms of size of fish, it isn't like we're going to lose muskies in these lakes if we don't do this. It's more about angler preferences. So it carries quite a bit of weight, the comments that we get from those meetings, and some may go through and some may not based on the comments received.
Senator Osmond.
So just to follow up, so then based on your comments, it would be feasible, however, to have the rules in place prior to opener 2016. If we decided to amend this to include that, we could create that mechanism.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick, yes.
Senator Skoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Osmick's point, which I think is very good, and I want to go back to 2015. What's the holdup on the timeline? Is it the posting requirement?
Mr. Vargas.
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, it's a combination of there's a posting requirement followed by public meeting requirement followed by just the whole rulemaking process requirement. So it takes a year, basically, to do the process.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Bogus. So you have to post it for 90 days prior to what? I'm not tracking why that's a holdup because, I mean, the ice is still on. Nobody's fishing now. So if you were to post it now, you know, why won't that work through? I'm not tracking.
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, it could work through if we're prepared to identify those 24 lakes before the opener, which is typically what we would do is post before the opener. It just has to be 90 days. We do it prior to the opener just to give people the maximum chance to be aware of it on that particular lake because that's when we get the most
Mr. Chair,
and/or visits.
Mr. Chair, I don't know where we're going to go, but if Senator Osbick makes a motion, I'm going to support it.
It seems to me I've been hearing you say, Mr. Bogus, that you're in the process of doing this, and so how long does being in the process take you? Because I think that's what the Muskie people are concerned about, that nothing's happening because it's taking so long for things to happen. And now you sit here and tell us that you can't get it done in a year. And I've been listening to you say that you're in the process of doing it. So I think the 2015 date is probably a reasonable date. And I think the 56-inch idea is probably a reasonable idea on 24 lakes, that because if we find out that that works, we can maybe go to other lakes if we have to in the near future. But that does sound like a reasonable compromise if we put a timeline on here. Senator Rood.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's exactly my point that we've all been trying to make. As you talk about the timeline, and we're in the process, and we can't do it in a year, and then we can't do it, and then we haven't identified 24 lakes. And I think that's the whole question here. If it's going to take us and the DNR 2 to 3 years down the line to maybe do this, I think that's a big question, because we could do this now, or we can, we can come back next year and say, guess what, we're still in the process and we can maybe do it 2016, no, maybe 2017. So I think the timeline is a very important issue here.
Okay. Senator Scalzi, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had a question I don't know who could answer it. So we're to believe that there are no metro lakes that have muskies that are not the tiger muskies. Is that it? Or are there some regular muskies that are not the tiger muskies in the metro area?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, I'm not positive if there are none, but we specifically have listed those tiger muskie lakes in the regulations with a lower size maximum in the rules, just because we know they'll never get to be even 48 inches. So, but I'm not positive if there are no lakes. I know we have some brood lakes here, but we don't allow fishing on those. So, and there may be somebody here from Muskies Inc. that knows that.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you.
Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Probably Chair. The question then would be, if it's a social thing with fishermen, Mr. Bogus, how many Muskie folks have gotten a hold of you and wanted this thing increased over the last year? What would trigger that? We're going to open public meetings, and this is really getting to be an issue that we probably going to have to move forward with. What triggers that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, I know there's been a lot of discussion about muskie minimum sizes for the last several years, and what we have in progress right now is just the basic statewide minimum size going from 48 to 50. We have not identified the list of 24 or so lakes. That would be kind of the second phase of the process that we were working on. So, but it's been a pretty active topic of discussion with the musk lunge interest for the last couple of years.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I got a few questions. Can you repeat what is the size of a tiger muskie? They don't even get to 48 inches, and yet that's our current standard. How do we deal with that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, we actually have that. There's a kind of a statewide standard of 48, but there's an exception for tiger muskie lakes where it's 40 currently.
So what do they normally get if they don't get to 48, but the minimum is 40? That doesn't much difference.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, they can reach 40 inches or a little bit longer, but that's about it.
So really, we have a standard that they barely make. Nobody can keep a tiger muskie for the most part.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, they can keep the very large ones, but most of them they cannot.
And physically, we've got the regulations, so they don't even. What you just said is they. Most don't even reach that size. What would be the purpose of having a regulation that is beyond would be beyond what genetics grow them to be?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, the purpose is to allow some harvest of trophy muskellunge right now. If we went to a 48 or a 55-inch minimum for those tiger muskellunge lakes, it would be actually just probably more straightforward to just say muskies are catch and release on those lakes, because there would never be one that you could keep.
Sure. So I heard earlier discussion that the muskie fishermen have went from 31,000 licensed to 110,000 licensed. Where do we project this going? Are we going to increase that number more by going to 50 or 55 inches? And what number? I mean, that seems like a lot of increase in recent years under the current rules. So what's the projection? Is that number going up or down?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, there isn't a separate license, so that's an estimate based on survey data, and it has been increasing. It's increasing in popularity. I don't know that we've tried to project where that's going in a few years, but it's definitely been increasing in popularity.
So another question. Some years ago, Meltona, I remembered the discussion, and a lot of lake owners, homeowners, that use the lake for recreation and have kids out there and worry about these big fish coming close to their docks and scaring their kids and even biting. Let me ask you this question, because I Googled it, and I was surprised what I found, but how many bites are you aware of? Because it does show up on the Internet, and we've had them here in Minnesota. What do you know about that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, I know that it has happened on a rare occasion, but it's very unusual.
Okay.
What did you find out when you Googled it?
Well, Mr. Chair, there was more articles than I could read in the time I had. So the last one the one that sticks out is a kid up in Andover, 11 years old, stuck his hand in the dock to clean a shirt and came up with a muskie attached to his finger. So,
how big was the muskie? Did he keep it there?
Well, it sent him to the hospital for stitches, according to the Star Tribune article.
Okay. Senator Saxog, if you'll entertain what Senator Osmek is thinking here, we got some. I don't know. Do you have some language that could possibly amend this amendment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've got a number of pieces here that I think could be helpful. I mean, but Senator Saxog does have an amendment in front of us. I mean, if you want me to read,
Senator
kind
Scoy
of.
Senator Scoy has one. Or was
Senator Saxog has moved to delete Section 49, but Senator Osmek is thinking of amending his amendment by amending the language that's in there. So I don't know if we can.
Well, here.
Let me make the suggestion of what you're thinking, and then maybe Senator Saxog can withdraw.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm very amenable to.
Don't be amenable yet. Wait, let's hear what he has to say.
But to making a change and much in the thought of the table, but I think we probably ought to clean the slate and then write the new amendment.
Okay, so let's withdraw the Saxog amendment momentarily.
I was going to say we could.
You want to eliminate the Section 49 and
start then
over?
Rewrite it, yeah.
Let me hear what the language might be, because maybe it just has to amend this language.
Well, Mr. Chair, there are a couple of things going on here. The first thing would be in 23.16, we would insert by March 1, 2015. On line 20, page 23, line 15, before the first the, I guess there's only one, comma. And then there's also the issue of those of metropolitan lakes. So on 23.17, after waters, after the end of the line, insert comma, except for muskellunge hyphen northern pike hybrid lakes in the seven-county metropolitan area, comma. So we would accept those wouldn't be part of this. And then on line 23.18, I think you're talking about deleting 55 and inserting 50 there for the general?
No.
No, what we would want them to do is we want them to do 56 in some lakes. And
no, I understand that. But, okay. But Mr. Chair, the department was talking about having a general rule of 50 statewide, and then some lakes would be higher. I haven't gotten to the some lakes would be higher part.
Right.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, Senator Osmond is shaking his head. So we would delete 55 and insert 50. And then after length, you would, before the period, insert and establish higher size limits for individual lakes. Now, the issue here, though, is they have a process for that in the special management waters. And so I think to make this complete, we would need to add Minnesota Statute Section 97C.005 does not apply to the establishment of size limits for individual lakes under this section, comma, except the commissioner shall hold a public meeting in the area designated at least 90 days prior to adoption of the rule. You don't have to have that last part, but I just thought generally you have meetings in the areas before they go and do this. That's part of what's in 97C 001 or 005, 005, excuse me. Okay. And so the question is do you want them to still hold the meeting at least in the area so people know that it's coming? Right. And so I thought we should be complete and make sure that we exempt them from that section, because these are going to be part of the rule, not part of the special management waters listed, similar to the metro lakes are part of the rule. And so that was
number of lakes.
That's basically what I have for language for that. And that would be added to the language that's already here. So it allows the commissioner to go through, do the good cause exemption, but they have until March 1st so they can identify those lakes and then go to the 50. And it would be done in time for the 2015 fishing season.
March.
And would the language that you just said have the intent of getting some of the other lakes, the 24 lakes, up to 56?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, they would have to go through. Mr. Bogus explained that they haven't really figured out what the 24 lakes are. But it would be it would say to establish higher size limits. If you wanted to say a size limit of 56 on other individual lakes, we could do that. I just said to establish higher size limits for those lakes, and they could do it kind of lake by lake depending on the capacity.
What's the pleasure here?
So, Mr. Chair, I would withdraw my motion in favor of this one.
Okay.
Senator Osmick makes that.
So Senator Saxon withdraws his motion. Senator Osmick, you want to make this motion that we're talking about. Senator Dietzick, you have a comment.
I have a
question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does March 1st give him, and I think somebody asked this before, but does March 1st give him time to make the 2015 fishing season, and then do we mandate them to establish the higher size lakes in time for the 2015? Or because even Mr. Baca said this has been an active topic for a couple of years, so my concern is that they do, you know, they might do part by the 15 and then say, oh, we didn't have time to get to all of that. And so I just want to make sure this language gets most of this or all of this, and can we get all of this adjusted for the 2015, whenever that muskellunge season opener is?
The 50 would be established before, for sure, right?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, the 50 would be established before, and it would be whatever lakes they can come up with, they would have this window to increase the size limit on those lakes through this shortened process, which would be different than their more extensive process that they do under special management. And the reason I chose March 15th is most of the times we have regulations change on March 1st. And they could do it before that, whatever time they would need to get it into the fishing regulations prior to that date. But it would give them until then, again, when we make most game and fish law changes, especially dealing with licenses, whatever, is March 1st. I mean, you could pick a different date if the department could do it faster than that if they need to get it to the 2015 season.
So to the
new amendment then, so that still gives the discretion of the DNR to raise, I think what the chairman's talking about, the 56 limit. It still gives them the discretion to name those lakes specifically for the 56 inch over the 50.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and it doesn't say 56. It could. It doesn't right now. It just says to establish higher size limits for individual lakes. And, Mr. Chair, yeah, so you would have kind of three parts. You'd have the metro lakes. They would stay at 40 because they're accepted from this, the metro tiger muskie lakes. And you would have 50 statewide would be established before March 1st of 2015. And then also you would give the agency the authority to do by rule rather than special management waters. As long as they hold a meeting in the area, you would give them by rule to establish higher levels or higher limits, size limits, in additional lakes. And you don't put a number on it, and you give them that discretion.
you make that work.
So I'm sorry, I'm somewhat confused about that. It's hard for me to be confused. Don't they already have that authority now under the rules? Well, the last part?
It's changing something.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, they do, but they usually go through the special management waters provision and statute that provides, I think Mr. Bogg has talked a little bit about that, requires the posting 90 days in advance, holding a meeting in the local area, and it provides a lot of public input before they do it. This would say that they could do it through rule, but they would have to have some public input in the area. So they do have that authority, but this would allow for them to do it quicker before the 2015 fishing season.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bogus, being that this has been a topic of conversation, you must have some idea of some of these lakes and how many you might have a guess at would be going to the 56. I mean, do you have an idea that there's going to be 12 or 15 or 18? Any ideas?
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, we think it's going to be about 24, but we don't know exactly.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would propose that perhaps we contemplate including something like at least 20 lakes would be at the 56 level. And clearly they have contemplated this, and they should be able to reach that target.
And Mr. Chair, I'd accept that as a friendly amendment.
And then there, Senator Rood.
So does this get any lakes to 56 by the 2015 fishing season?
At least 20.
That's what Senator Skoy is trying to do right now.
Well, I know that they're going to get to the 50 by the 2015, but does it get us? Do any of the others get to there?
Senator Skoy's intent is to do 20 lakes
by
the 2015 season.
By
the 2015
okay.
season, and
Mr. Knopf
is trying to figure out how to put it in the language. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
No, Mr. Boggs.
Just a thought on that is that if it was that we had to propose 20 lakes and hold meetings on 20 lakes, we don't know what the outcome of those meetings is going to be. If we have to go ahead and designate them, regardless, I just question the need to do the public meetings then if we're just going to designate them no matter what we hear.
15?
Well, he's saying don't hold the public meetings and just designate 20 lakes.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think what he's saying is that they don't know the outcome of the public meeting, but some of these public meetings, the outcome is going to be resulting in 56 as their. Now, we don't know what it is, probably not 30 and maybe not 24, but certainly if they hold 24 public hearings at potential lakes, over half of them, I would guess, would result in this. So I think we should put something in there as a criteria.
I agree.
I don't know what the number is, but I think we should put something in there.
At least.
Well, Mr. Chair, let's split the fish in half. 24 was brought up. Let's say 12. And if we want to specifically, and I'm sort of assuming that Mr. Bogus will already admit that Mille Lacs Lake is probably going to be one of them, we could even specifically designate Mille Lacs as one of the 12. Because I know Senator Root certainly would love to have Mille Lacs called out and make sure that they are part of the increased level.
Senator Root.
Well, Mr. Chair, aren't you doing exactly what you said that we shouldn't do, and that's make the decisions for the DNR? Is that
Amen.
Exactly what you're doing right here?
Well, compromise.
Well, that was an hour ago.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Root, we're trying to get to a point where everybody can agree here. Yeah. And quite frankly, what we're trying to do is make sure the DNR does it in a timely fashion. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is that since they think they can go to 56, people want to go to 55, but we aren't there yet. And if we designate all the lakes, we don't exactly know if that's going to work. So we've got a whole bunch of things that are in the middle of this so that I think we're getting to a point where this is going to be a really, really good compromise that no one's going to be happy in that. And so that should be a good compromise. Senator Skoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi brought up that we did such a good job with the wolves that I thought we would.
Mr. Chair, I think the goal of 20 is certainly reasonable, you know, and if the public meetings come up and say that these, you know, these are fine and these aren't, I think if we have a goal of 20, I think that's certainly reasonable.
All right.
Fine, leave it there.
Okay with that? Okay, we're leaving it there. At 20. Okay, what's the new language? So everybody, why don't you read the new article, or the new section, I mean.
The new section would read.
I want 55.
I'll read the entire section with all the language together.
All right.
By March 1, 2015, the Commissioner of Natural Resources shall amend Minnesota Rules Part 6262.0200 to provide that the minimum size limit for muskellunge in all inland waters, except for muskellunge-northern pike hybrid lakes in the seven-county metropolitan area, is 50 inches in length and shall establish a size limit of 56 inches for at least 20 individual lakes. And that's period. The commissioners may use, I won't read that, the good cop, that's the basically the exempt rulemaking stuff. The next three lines are. And then, well, actually, before that, we would insert, I think we should leave that at the end. I've got it moving up. We would insert after the period on 23.18, we insert Minnesota statutes section 97C.005 does not apply to establishment of size limits. For individual lakes under this section, except the commissioner shall hold a public meeting in the area of the lake at least 90 days prior to adoption of in the area of the lakes at least 90 days prior to the adoption of the rule.
Okay, everybody got that? All right. So on the OSMIC motion, Senator Schmidt.
Mr. Chair, I just ask for a roll call when we get to these amendments.
All right.
So,
okay.
Mr. Chair, just one really tiny question.
Go ahead.
So we're going to demand that the DNR do the 56. We're not going to allow them the opportunity to do 55 or 54 in those lakes, do half of them at 54 and the rest at 56. Okay. It's going to be 56 no matter what for those 20 lakes on this amendment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, that's where I thought the discussion was going. I had at one point just said increased, and people seem to want at least 56 inches and at least 20 lakes.
Yeah. Mr. Chair,
Senator Westrom. Mr. Chair, for the DNR, you're the fish experts. Can the muskie grow that big, or are we setting the limit kind of like tiger muskie beyond what most of them will ever grow?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, the muskies can grow that big in certain lakes, but I believe the state record for Minnesota right now is a 56-inch muskie, so not very many of them will.
57, I think we saw in the video.
Yeah, 57
the other day
in the video. So,
but okay. So we basically are setting a threshold. Why don't we just set it at 85 inches, and then we know they'll never get there. I'm being facetious, Mr. Chair. Another half serious question. Let me use this Andover kid for example. Is it like dogs? If a fish bites you, you can euthanize them? Is that right?
Mr. Chair, with dogs, there's obviously disease issues, rabies, and so forth. So
I'm not sure.
There's no specific provision for killing a fish that bites a person.
Senator Hoffman, I'm going to allow you to ask a question, but our answers are.
I'm deeply grateful, Mr. Chair. There are no muskie lakes in Andover, Minnesota, just for the record. So I don't know where that story came from. But
okay. All right.
So
roll call has been requested on the OSMIC amendment.
We're
going to
amend it.
You take the roll.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
What? Somebody else want to say something?
Could I amend the amendment? Yes? No?
Sure.
12 lakes instead of 20.
It's up to you and Osmond and Rude.
Let's keep her here. We get peace here.
Yeah, we can do that
12.
Later, I guess.
All right.
Yeah. Let's do the roll call. Chair votes aye.
Senator Dietzick.
Aye.
Senator Herr.
Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
No.
Senator Osmond.
Yes.
Senator Rood.
No.
Senator Saxon.
Yes.
Senator Scalzi.
No.
Senator Schmidt.
No.
Senator Skoy.
Yes.
Senator Sparks?
No.
Senator Weber?
No.
Senator Westrum?
Decider.
Ass, Madam Chair.
You're one, you're
the only one left.
Senator Westrum.
I'll say yes.
On a vote of 7-6, the motion is adopted. Okay. Are there other amendments to the bill? Senator Sackbaum.
Mr. Chair, the A8 amendment.
I don't care at all.
A8 amendment. Can we distribute the A8 amendment? It's in the.
I think
packets.
It's in your. I think it's in your.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair. Just clarification. Was Senator Smith named call for vote?
Wait a second.
Yes.
Okay.
A8. Okay. Senator Sackbaum, the A8 amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, the A8 amendment has to do with ATVs. The first part of the amendment, Section 6, makes minor changes on definitions of ATVs. It allows ATV equipped with non-pneumatic tires, airless tires, to be legally registered as an ATV. Section 7 alters Class 1 all-terrain vehicles' weight from dry land weight to be less than 1,000 to be less than 1,200. And Section 8 on Class 2 all-terrain vehicles allows the dry weight to, instead of being 1,000, less than 1,000, less than 1,200 to 1,800 pounds. So with that, I think we have some people here that are prepared to testify, and look for your support.
Mr. Meyer.
Or comments or whatever.
Mr. Chairman, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. This language is the result of an agreement of several meetings that the department has had with industry over the past several months. It does have bicameral bipartisan support with all the people we've talked with. It basically sets the sideboards now and into the future on what the width and the looks of these machines are. In the past, we've been kind of changing the language as we've gone because of the weights and really not focusing on what the real limitation of the system is, which is the side limits. So I think this language is if we can adopt this language, changes will not be needed for quite some time to these definitions. And that was our ultimate goal, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Myers, if this is a result of a working group report, or how come it's not in a bill that went through the policy committee?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, the finalization of the language had just occurred after first committee deadline, so we did not have a chance, at least the department did not have a chance to get it into a bill format through our processes. I apologize for that, but it did take some time and effort for us to get to this point.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Myers, how many years has this language been in place as it is?
Mr.
Meyer. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knopf may be able to assist us on that. The last time it was amended, I want to say, was 2010, possibly.
Mr. Chair, I think that this is a pretty major change to ATV legislation. I don't know who was on the working group. I think that they should introduce a bill next year and run it through the process. I think that they're changing the nature of vehicles that are utilized on our trails without us really understanding what's going on for sure there. And I'm not going to support this amendment. And I would urge the committee to encourage them to introduce a bill and take this through the process.
Looks to me like Minnesota statute is 2012. So is that when it was last changed?
Mr. Chair, that's just when they were published. This is the last time it was published.
Okay. Go ahead. What's your name?
My name is J.R. Burke. I'm with Polaris Industries.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I just wanted to address your concern there about the intermingling of the different types of vehicles. There's two types of trail systems in Minnesota, Class 1 and Class 2, and under management practice today, the vast majority of Class 1 trails, which you would typically think of as the straddle seat, handlebar steering type machine are actually open to side-by-side vehicles, which this amendment specifically goes to. What the reason that this amendment is important is that manufacturers, not only Polaris but others, are running up against federal mandates, which are resulting in us having to make design changes that refer back to weight. So we are trying to provide an incremental change in the definition to help us address that issue and also be able to provide opportunities for additional types of vehicles to be accessible on the trail system, but also preserve the traditional Class 1 trail system. Mr. Meyer mentioned briefly that we're working in a stakeholder group that includes looking for additional opportunities to address Senator Scoy's concern, which is that there are adequate opportunities for traditional ATVs to be operated on public land here in the state, and we'll continue to have that conversation and share that same desire.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for not catching your name. What's the interaction between this proposed change to state requirements and the federal mandates?
Chairman Tomasoni, Senator Scoy, the Consumer Product Safety Commission regulates all-terrain vehicles currently, the traditional straddle seat handlebar steering machines. They're also in the midst of rulemaking pertaining to side-by-side vehicles, or what are referred to as recreational off-highway vehicles. Those would be your typical Razor or Ranger type of Polaris vehicles, but also similar vehicles produced by other domestic and non-domestic manufacturers. What's happening, it's a little bit technical, but there are design standards which are related back to vehicle width, weight, and lateral stability, things of that nature, which have forced manufacturers like Polaris to increase the weight of our vehicles in order to meet those standards. And we have been, not just in Minnesota, but in a number of other states, had to go back and make incremental changes to the statute to help us address that concern and still allow those vehicles to be registered in the state and used on public land.
Well, Mr. Chair, members can do what they want. I'm not going to support it, but it seems to me that this should have gone through the process. We're going to be around here again next year. I would encourage you to do this through the process, but whatever.
Senator Schmidt, do you have an opinion on this?
You know, I have heard no concern. I understand where Senator Scoy is coming from here on this. One of the points that was made to me is that this is dealing with a competitiveness issue, and I'm not sure if our testifier would like to speak to that at all, but the market's changed considerably, and this is what I had heard. It was trying to bring a statute up to par with that. I don't know if testifier would like to weigh in on that.
Senator Schmidt, Chairman Tomasoni, that is correct as well. Is Polaris, as well as other manufacturers of these vehicles, spend millions of dollars each year to understand our consumer, and what we know is that the traditional ATV enthusiast is aging. In fact, their age is over 50 years old now, and there's two consequences of that. Number one is there are concerns about future registration dollars in the state for existing DNR trail infrastructure, but there's also concerns about providing additional opportunities for those enthusiasts of the traditional ATV to get out on the trail system and enjoy it as they continue to age. What we have found is that side-by-sides are that vehicle that folks are increasingly looking for. I don't think it's a coincidence that Polaris introduced the first 50-inch side-by-side in 2008, and now Articat, our chief competitor here in this state, also introduced a 50-inch side-by-side. It's because the consumer is speaking loudly that they want these sorts of vehicles. The importance of these vehicles, and I think why there is some similarities and some opportunities with the trail system, is that they're narrow. They're essentially the same footprint as a two-up ATV. And Polaris just also recently launched a Sportsman Ace to fit into that category. They're designed for tight, twisty, narrow, slower-speed trail systems, so that we don't infringe on those traditional ATV enthusiasts that like to get out there and enjoy those same experiences. And we've been having those conversations for, as Mr. Meyer explained, with not only the DNR but the ATV Association of Minnesota and our other competitors to make sure that we address all the various concerns.
Okay. Senator Root.
Mr. Chair, can you tell us, Senator Scoy mentioned about the task force, the working group. Could you tell us who that was? I mean, who was on that worked on that group?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ruth, there's all the manufacturers basically in Minnesota and in the main manufacturers. So it was Polaris, Arctocat, Bombardier or BP. The representative from Yamaha was there. I believe Suzuki was there as well. Also the All-Terrain Vehicle Association in Minnesota, our enforcement division, our Parks and Trails division, myself. Trying to think who else was there. Several members of Parks and Trails and Enforcement Division. So basically the manufacturers and the enthusiast groups and the department.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, where are the riders in that group of people? I mean, you know, the people using the trails. I get the manufacturer's issue here.
You said the All-Terrain Vehicle Association.
Association was there?
Yes.
No, I didn't hear that.
Okay.
Any further comments? Okay, then on the Saxhawk motion on the 8-8, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted. Any other amendments?
Mr. Chair, there is an 8-10 amendment, I think, before you.
Is this yours?
Yeah, I can offer it. It's part technical, and I guess I'd just as soon have Mr. Knopf speak to it if you could.
The 8-10 amendment is the same as Senate File 2663 and has been heard in the Environment Energy Committee and Transportation and Public Safety Committee. This bill established designation of 100% disabled person to be put on the driver license so that they don't have to keep bringing their papers in when they get their licenses. So today's amendment includes some changes to accommodate DNR concern as well as make sure that we have the same language as in the House.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the differences are Section 19 on 1.3 to 1.9. 19, that's of the amendment. First page, page 1. It's 1.3 to 1.19. That's a little different from the way the bill came into committee. There's a new kind of clause 6 to make sure that these people have permanently disabled. And then the actual license provision you'll find on page 3, 3.26, and so on. And you'll see that it's trying to tie it in. It wanted to make sure that to get this on your driver's license or your card, your identification card, that it would be only tied to those. It'd be, if you look on 3.34, it's clauses 1, 4, 5, or 6. So if you look back, you'll see that it's somebody who's blind, workers' compensation and total and permanent, 65 years or older, was qualified, or 6. So it wouldn't apply to 2 and 3 because but 2 and 3 are actually could be part of 6 because if you're permanently disabled. They wanted to make sure there was a permanent disability. So that's the difference between the way the bill was. And this has been worked out with the department, and it is the language is the same way as it reads now in the House bill.
Okay. Any discussion or comments or questions of anybody? Okay, so on the Schmidt motion for the 8-10 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Or no, this is the HER motion, right?
Right.
No. I apologize. Okay, all opposed. Motion is adopted. Okay. Any other amendments? Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair.
I have the A13 amendment. I think that's right. Is that right, Mr.
Yes.
Knopf? This relates to the testimony we heard on Monday. Mr. Chair, since we've been able to work out language, and that's the revised amendment that Mr. Knopf has is the 813, and I'd move that. Mr. Chair, what that the DNR and Mr. Peter Meyer are working out an arrangement, and they think they can likely get there, and we've made good progress in the last 2 days. And so I don't want to Mr. Meyer can confirm, but this would be language they're okay with, and they think there's a good chance we can get this worked out for a peer, and that would be paid for by the private sector or the group that's Freeport Family Fishing. and this would be language that would be workable at this time to keep things moving along.
Mr. Meyer, this doesn't look like it's too difficult for you to comply to this one, does it?
Mr. Chairman, no. First of all, we'd like to thank the work of the Freeborn County Group. They're, as I was speaking with the witness or the individual, the conservation ethic in the state would be nowhere without these small conservation groups, so we really appreciate the work they're doing. Our main concerns regarded liability and things, I think we're working through those. This amendment keeps us moving forward in the right direction, and I think we can solve this issue pretty easily. So we do support the amendment.
Senator Westrum, you know, Mr. Petermeyer wasn't going to come back, but he's starting to like this place. You know, you might have an opponent in the next election. You never know. He's pretty good.
Mr. Chair, if this amendment doesn't go on, I'm afraid of that.
So. All right, on the 813 amendment, any other discussion? Seeing none, all of the favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And Mr. Chair. Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, another thing that's in this bill is an appropriation from the Game and Fish Fund for the shooting sports grants, and that was already passed in the budget bill that we passed off the floor yesterday. So instead of double counting that, I recommend that we remove sections 9 and 53 out of the bill. Again, those have already passed in the overall budget bill, and we shouldn't be double tracking those.
The overall budget bill doesn't pass.
Yeah.
Right. Mr. Chairman, usually the Finance Committee does not like having two same exact appropriations traveling in two different bills.
Which sections are we talking about?
Section 53 in the bill would be the actual appropriation. That is on page 24. It's for $2 million. And then there's some enabling language for the actual grants that I guess that could possibly stay in the bill.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Mueller, it doesn't read exactly the same. We added a sentence to that in Senator Tomasoni's bill. So I think it would be better to leave that out since the money, have a travel with the money.
Yeah.
So we're just deleting Section 53?
And Section 9.
Yeah.
And Section 9. Yeah. Okay, so Senator Ingebretson moves that we delete Section 9 and Section 53 in the bill. You understand what's going on, Senator Schmidt? Okay.
Support this.
Okay. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion adopted. Senator Westrum.
Chair, another very small issue. Senator Schmidt, they talked about it with the trespassing law. I talked to the DNR, and I think Mr. Knopf has a slight change to the trespassing change that will address their issue relating to trespass, but also not undo the issue that we resolved for my constituent a couple years ago. Mr. Knopf, do you have that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it would be on page 15, line 11, delete public and insert state-owned or and I don't know, there could be some locally owned lands. I mean, we've been doing some things with Anoka County Parks and things like that. So I didn't know if you want to put state-owned or locally owned land.
I think that would be fine, Mr. Knopf.
I think the issue that you have is with the federally owned.
Federally owned, right.
Yes. So, Mr. Chair, it would be delete public, insert state-owned or locally owned.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, this language is something that Senator Westrum and I talked about so that the changes we're making now to protect the state lands does not impact his constituent. Once we have this larger stakeholder discussion over the interim to talk about the harassment of livestock, I believe the solution we'll come back with next session will allow us to fix this piece. We just want to make sure that Senator Westrum's constituent is not caught up in this transition period, but also protect the state land interests.
Mr. Chair, could I just modify that just slightly? I was thinking locally owned isn't very well defined, and I think it would just be state-owned or local government-owned, and I think that would make sense. Then it would be so it'd have to be owned by local government or the state.
I'd move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any discussion? Any comments? Yep. Go ahead. Go ahead. Just say your name for the record.
My name is Kimberly Dimmick. I'm the owner of Dakota Ridge Stables. Many of you have already heard my testimony in the last three committee hearings we've been in. In the Judiciary Committee, we had an issue with interpretation of the first line of discharging a firearm. Since then, we've done some research, and we're confident that as it's written, will cover us legally as what we were seeking. And there were also some issues on Monday with Senator Westrom, with his constituents and whether they would be protected with these changes, which is one of the wording changes they did to help him on that. But I just wanted to bring this to everybody's attention on how this does protect us even more than it used to. Before, the only protection we had was 500 feet from a stockade or corral, 1 acre in size. Not many people have a corral that's only 1 acre. The average pasture is probably 5 or greater. 1 acre corrals are usually up towards the buildings. And the comment came up in judiciary hearing, what if that livestock is, you take it outside of that corral, are they covered anymore? So by changing this law to have 500 feet from a building protects us from when we have that animal outside of that pen, still gives the hunters the hunting area they need under the changes that they've made. And I also wanted to address one other thing. In the judiciary hearing, my testimony ended up getting a little too personal for some people. So I brought some statistics with me so you guys can understand how important a 500-foot rule is.
Let me ask you a question. Are you happy with the language?
I am. Okay. Now, after we've researched...
Don't screw it up then, okay?
Okay. I just wanted to kind of give some more input to the distance of bullet travels and sound.
We don't need that here. This is the finance you guys have.
Sure.
You're moving along just fine. Yeah, we're making a slight tweak, Mr. Chair, so I appreciate your testimony, but I think...
Great. Yes, we're happy with, after researching the language, we're happy with the way it sits as of now.
Okay. And on the oral amendment by Senator Westrom, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Okay, Senator Schmidt.
Mr. Chair, I'd like, if there are no other further amendments, Senator Ingebrigtsen, go ahead.
Yep. Senator Ingebrigtsen, you have an amendment?
I have a couple amendments.
Okay, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I'd like to offer the A-12 amendment, Mr. Chair.
What?
No. I'm not going to waste your time.
Gizzard shad. What in the world are gizzard shad?
You're about to learn, Mr. Chair. I know now.
Okay. YouTube videos. We got Senator Ingebrigtsen on
without videos, man. Without videos, Mr. Chair, I'll try and explain to you what gizzard shad is. Mr. Chair and members, thank you. And Senator Schmidt, we talked out in the hallway with a stakeholder, and he is here, actually, patiently waiting, been here since noon or 1 o'clock. And if he would come forward, Mr. DeMars could explain what this is about. But basically what it is about two bodies or two rivers in the state of Minnesota. And I think before I get in too deep over my head without a life jacket, I'll probably turn it over to him.
Good idea.
And he can explain what this is about, and he can explain what gizzard shad is and why it's sought after by some of our sportsmen here in the state. So Mr. DeMars is here, retired full colonel, by the way, who's got time now to come in and enjoy the legislature today. So please go ahead if you wouldn't identify yourself.
Just say yourself, say your name for the record, and then go ahead and tell us about gizzard shad.
My name is Stephen DeMars. As the senator indicated, I have the enviable task of being, when I announce my occupation, I'm retired. And it's absolutely wonderful for those of you that'll be getting there. The reason I'm here today is I'm the designated representative of the Catfish and Sturgeon Alliance. Many of you probably haven't heard of that or even know what it is. It's a loose-knit band of river rats. Most of us fish at night, very late at night, and we're after big catfish and sturgeon. And the reason I bring that up is the way we fish is much different than the way anybody else fishes. The musky guys will tell you the way they fish is different than everybody, and the walleye guys are different, but we use big baits, and we like to get as fresh a bait as we can.
You don't go in the water and put your hand in the mouth. And
no, we don't do that. I had several people ask me about that today, and I said, anybody who spent time on the river seen those big snapping turtles that are about that big around? They live in the same place. Those people are sticking their hands, and I wouldn't go after a big cat or a snapping turtle.
It's called noodling, I believe.
Is that what it is? Yeah.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, I think they only practice that in Oklahoma.
That's it.
Missouri.
Okay. All right. I've seen it on TV.
I provided you all... there's a copy of what I'm going to go through, and it's about a two-page document with the language at the end that we would like to see enacted. What I'm going to talk to you about is a proposal to allow the use of throw nets. That's sometimes called a cast net. And we want to do that for the harvest of gizzard shad. And most of you are going to go, what's a gizzard shad? And I will tell you that in Minnesota, there are billions and billions of gizzard shad. They're the prime forage fish for catfish and sturgeon on the Mississippi, the Minnesota River, and the St. Croix River. It's been estimated that gizzard shad consists of approximately 35% to 40% of the river's entire forage base. Their native range includes the Great Lakes, the Mississippi, and the Ohio River drainages. In late spring, gizzard shad spawn. They're getting ready to spawn right now. As early as age two, they gather in the shallows. And a single female gizzard shad can lay between 300,000 and 500,000 eggs. Now picture that in your mind. A female lays 500,000 eggs, and there's thousands and thousands of them. And in no time at all, usually within 2 to 3 days, those gizzard shad hatch, and everything starts eating them. And from then on, everything is chasing them. Walleyes, white bass, smallmouth bass, all those kinds of things. But these gizzard shad grow fast. By the fall of that first year, they'll grow to 2 to 4 inches. Growth is very rapid, up to 7 inches in the first year. The adult size is typically 10 to 15 inches, can reach 20 inches. They usually weigh about a pound or less, but they can reach 3.5 pounds. Gizzard shad provide forage for most game species. One unique thing about them, they're plankton eaters. They very seldom bite on a hook. They are the most highly sought after bait by catfishermen and sturgeon fishermen. And this is where the problem comes in. On Minnesota streams and rivers, designated as infested waters, the Mississippi River and the St. Croix River are infested waters. The harvest of bait is limited to hook and line methods only. As I said, gizzard shad are plankton eaters, and they don't bite on a bite on a hook. In order to legally use a throw net, we need to amend Minnesota Statute 84D03, Subdivision 3, to authorize the use of a throw net to harvest gizzard shad from streams and rivers designated as infested waters. Now, throw nets is a common practice, a fairly common practice in the collection of bait for fishing, and is a common practice for the harvest of gizzard shad for bait. We did a quick review of the regulations throughout the country, and we found 28 states that allow the use of cast nets. Now, what we're proposing is that you allow us to use cast nets to harvest gizzard shad. There's some issues, which are facts, around the use of cast nets. There are aquatic invasive species issues concerning the use of throw nets on infested waters. Once that net is used, it becomes contaminated, and it could cause the spread of AIS if used in another water body. We've studied this, our alliance and our work group that worked on this, and we've looked at every possible way to authorize the use of cast nets and still mitigate the risks associated with AIS. And what we've come up with and makes the most sense is if we only allow the use of cast nets in infested waters, they aren't going to spread. That cast net can only be used in an infested water, not in an uninfested water. There are other concerns around a cast net. When you broadcast that net, it'll catch virtually everything. So every once in a while, there's going to be a walleye in there, a smallmouth bass in there, a crappie or a sunfish. Most other states that allow them have strict regulations that any game fish caught in a cast net are immediately returned to the water. And that's what we are proposing too. The existing statutes that's on the books, 84D, also right now addresses the use of the bait, prohibitions on the transportation of bait, and the size and the limit restrictions. All these provisions already in place would cover the use of a cast net. So our conclusion, our alliance, after looking at this thing inside and out and twisting and turning it and everything else, is that the use of throw nets, commonly called a cast net, for the harvest of gizzard shad on only designated infested streams and rivers pose no significant increase in risk to preclude their use as a means of harvesting shad for bait. And so what we're proposing to you is, and the language is shown and it's here, is that you allow us to use cast nets.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe the department could come up. My concern would be exactly what you're trying to address with your infested waters portion of this, but what if a river is infested for spiny water flea and, you know, you go to one that's got zebra mussels in it? They both would be considered infested, but you could be transmitting those organisms between waters.
I can address that for you. The only rivers with gizzard shad in them right now are the Mississippi River and the St. Croix River. Those are the only infested waters that contain gizzard shad. There are no rivers that I know of with any of those other aquatic invasive species.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, maybe the department would want to answer, but why don't we just limit the use of these throw nets to those two rivers then?
And I can answer that. Our constituency in the Alliance, the Catfish and Sturgeon Alliance, consists of a number of fishermen that fish the Minnesota River, the St. Croix River, and the Mississippi River. Those are the only rivers with flathead catfish in them, and the St. Croix and the Mississippi with sturgeon in them, which we fish the St. Croix River for sturgeon. Those are the only rivers that have those fish in them, and those are the only rivers that have those aquatic invasive species in them. We phrase this to say infested waters because my constituents on the Minnesota River were beating me about the head and shoulders because what about the Minnesota River? For those of you who are familiar with it, in a short period of time, eventually, it's going to become contaminated. Its confluence is with the Mississippi River. Sooner or later, it's going to be contaminated. So we phrase this to say infested waters because when it happens, then the Minnesota River can also be used for a cast net. For the short period until it's designated, they can't use it. But eventually they can, and we didn't want to have to come before you again and try to get the Minnesota River. So we wrote it in so that when it happens, they can use them there too.
Mr. Boggs.
Mr. Chair, and to the members and Senator Scully, I just want to maybe preface my comments by saying that we've been working with the catfish interests for several years, recognizing this is kind of a unique experience and quite an exciting thing to catch these big flathead catfish. And just for the committee's information, the language, the existing statutory language that's being proposed to be amended on lines 1.16 to 1.3, actually just passed in 2012. Prior to that time, it was illegal to take bait at all from infested waters. And so that was a provision that was trying to address some of the things that Mr. DeMars is talking about in terms of trying to help provide this unique method of fishing some more options to take large bait and use that large bait on infested waters. We do have some concerns. We are, I would say conceptually, we're okay with this, but we do have, and I will apologize that our fisheries chief is not here today because I most of my years of experience with the Fish and Wildlife Division were in the wildlife side, so I don't have the grasp of the distribution of gizzard shad in the state. But I do know we have 20 or 30 infested rivers in the state. They're infested for various reasons, as Senator Scully was talking about. Our Ecological and Water Resources Division is our lead division on aquatic invasive species. We're working with them on a risk assessment with bait harvest from infested waters, not only on this issue, but on Winnie and Lake of the Woods. We've got other people interested in other types of bait harvest from infested waters. We also have concern just with cast nets in general, in that they're prohibited in Minnesota because they're very effective and they will catch multiple species, and we just think we need to be very cautious about authorizing their use. And we have a lot of other people that would like to use cast nets, just not the cat fishermen. So there will be, if this is allowed, there will be other people lining up that want to use cast nets. But the way Mr. DeMars has described it for the Mississippi and St. Croix rivers, and if those nets could not be used anywhere else, were not authorized anywhere else, would probably have a similar, you know, risk to what is currently allowed for harvest of bullheads, gold eyes, moon eyes, sheep's head, et cetera, that you see on line 1.16, where they can only be taken on that body of water, they can only be used for bait on that body of water, they cannot be taken off that body of water. But I guess we have some concerns about this amendment as drafted, and in terms of the size of the cast nets, the type of material, whether it's monofilament or braided, the mesh size, the release of non-target species and all that, we think there's some details here that need to be worked through that have not been adequately addressed at this point.
Senator Root.
Mr. Chair and members, so this amendment comes from the Catfish Alliance, and they're considered to be the experts on this issue. And we just had an amendment from the Muskie Inc. that were not considered experts in this issue, and we had to defer to the DNR. So I would tell you I would be much more comfortable if we if this was given to the DNR to figure out with their concerns and come back to us at a later date.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Bogus or Mr. DeMars can talk about the transportation of this bait and how it's actually used. It's not used in its single form. I believe it's cut up. They're chopped up. That might be of interest. So as far as being released into a non-infested water, I don't know that would be an issue. But maybe Mr. DeMars can give us a little idea as to how many fishermen that actually do this specialized, unique fishing. I can say it's specialized and unique in that I did it myself last summer on the Mississippi, and it's quite different than the fishing I'm used to doing. They go out a lot of times after dark and fish till 2, 3 in the morning, and when you get one of these fish on the line, it's similar, I'm sure, to muskies, actually. But how many fishermen actually participate? How many are you talking about here?
The number is probably in the 100, 150, 200 probably, that are experienced, that chase them a lot. There's some that will go out once or twice a year and give it a go. It is highly specialized, and to get successful at it, it takes a lot of work. My success rate is I'm skunked 56% of the time. I keep track of every single trip and how often I go out and how many I catch. And 56% of the time, all I do is go out and listen to the Twins game and never get a bite. And then that one night you'll get it. Last summer I caught a 60-pound flathead catfish. I thought it was going to pull me out of the back of the boat. And once you catch one of those, every time I get a walleye now, just put it back. I don't want that thing. I want a big one. And that's what the most of us do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And they say the same about muskie. But, Mr., as a matter of fact, if that's the success rate, that'll be the last time I go. I have to have something on the line when I go fishing. But, Mr. Bogus, just a point of clarification. So So it's not. It's now required to release fish. You're required to release fish that are caught in these nets. Even if you're going after other bait, what would be the difference here?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, right now you can't use this type of a net at all in Minnesota. I think the basic principles of what's being proposed here are along the right track, and we'd like to work with this group. We've been working with this group to try to figure out a way to do it that minimizes the risk of spread of invasive species and still allows them to use the bait that they would like to use. But we also have other people that would love to use cast nets because they are very effective. They work very well, but we don't allow them anywhere in the state currently.
If I could make one more comment.
DeMars, go ahead.
In the handout I gave you, there's a YouTube video highlighted here in blue. After you leave here today or this evening, go on YouTube and watch that video. It's a gentleman in Texas where cast nets are legal, and it shows what a responsible sportsman who's using a cast net does. And it shows him catching quite a supply of fish, and there are game fish in there, and he's sorting them out and putting them back in the water. And when he's done, he's got his gizzard shad for the day's fishing. That's what a responsible sportsman does. He follows his fishing regulations. If your fishing regulation states all game fish will be returned to the water immediately after being caught, they'll go back in the water, and all we're going to have when we're done is shad. One other point I want to make. Gizzard shad are not a hardy bait fish. As soon as they come out of that net and you drop them in a bucket, they die. You can't keep them alive, especially when it's 75, 80, 90 degrees out. They don't last. Within minutes, they die. There are billions and billions of them out in the river systems, especially in late August, and they are dying by the thousands every day, and all the other fish are feeding off of them. Us cat fishermen cut them. What I want is a 10 to 15-inch fish, and I'll cut him up into three nice big chunks of bait about the size of your fist. And I put that on a great big hook, and I throw it out there. And the fish I'm trying to catch has got a mouth this big around, and he can take that bait like nothing. We don't want to use them alive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apologize, I'm blanking on your name. What are you currently using for bait?
I love 10-inch bullheads. Every time I can get a bullhead, I get them. I will also go out before I go, and I'll catch sheepheads and suckers, big ones, 15, 16, 17-inch suckers, and I'll cut them up into bait. I'll keep the head, and I'll fish the head, the same with sheephead. I catch all my bait. Every time I go out, I catch it first. I go out, and sometimes in the afternoon, I take the grandkids out, and they'll catch me a bunch of bait, and I'll put it in a cooler. And the grandkids catch my bait for me.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if the DNR has been working with this group for quite some time. I'm wondering why we're discussing a policy bill at this late date. It appears to me that they could have met committee deadlines had they presented their amendment in Senator Marty's.
It appears to me you're right, but Senator Ingebretson offered the amendment, and so that's why we're discussing it. So,
so could I move to amend the amendment and send it to the policy committee?
Well, is there a bill?
Well, there's an amendment.
I know, but we're past policy deadline now, so I don't know.
And I guess, you know, I've met all my deadlines, and I've kind of worked through the process. And
we could just vote no on this, and they could work on it together and maybe come up with some new language. I mean, that'd be a possibility, too, because you can send it to policy if you want, but it's not going to go anywhere this year. Senator Ingebretson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Boggess said they've been working with these guys for a long time, or with these groups for a long time, and I'm guessing I'm kind of going where Senator Scoy has gone here before with the DNR, wondering what's the holdup then? What's going to happen here to make this happen if you've been meeting continuously with these folks? What kind of an agreement are we going to come to? What would you like to see added or taken out of this amendment to make it right?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, as I pointed out earlier, we did change the regulations on bait harvest from infested waters in 2012 as a result of these meetings. And I know this issue came up at the roundtable in January. We're working with our Eco Waters Division that's our lead on infested waters and the whole Chapter 84D title. But we are looking at people desiring to take bait from multiple infested waters across the state, not just the cat fishermen, not just gizzard shad, not just cast nets. And so what we're doing right now with our other Eco Waters staff on the invasive species side is looking at all of these proposals to look at bait harvest from infested waters with the idea of coming back with something for next session.
Last comment.
Mr. Chair, well, that's encouraging in itself. And with that, I think it's the sentiment of the committee here that we continue to do that work. And I will withdraw the amendment on that very condition that you will get together with this group and come up with a resolve by next year, and it will come in bill form to the policy committee. And I really appreciate the discussion. So.
Senator Ingebrigtsen withdraws the E12 amendment. Any other amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
I would just ask the testifier, you know, if you're not making some progress, let us know.
Thank you. That's a good idea. Any other amendments? Senator Schmidt.
You know, Mr. Chair, we have a member who has gone during a previous conversation with Senator Sagsog's amendments regarding the muskie size limit, and I'd just like to move that we reconsider that amendment.
Okay. Senator Schmidt moves that we reconsider the muskie amendment.
And just with all due respect to staff time.
Mr. Chair, point of order.
Senator Osmond.
Senator Schmidt cannot make that motion because he was not on the prevailing side.
No, I don't committee. I don't think that matters in committee.
Doesn't matter in committee? All right.
And with all due respect to the staff and the time the committee spent on this issue, that's one of the reasons why we put this in place. There's a lot of discussion on the matter at the roundtable in January, a lot of frustration with just the lack of making traction on the matter, and that's why we wanted to solve it legislatively one time and for all. So I'll just leave my comments there and encourage folks to keep the language in that was originally in the bill before you today.
Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, the motion failed on a 7-6 vote. Mm-hmm. So if we add one more.
Passed
on a 7. Passed. Oh, it would fail if it was tied.
No, mm-hmm. It passed on
to reconsideration.
Seven.
Passed on a 7-6 vote. I was not thinking of that.
Okay. On the.
And Mr. Chair, would ask for a roll call again.
On the Schmidt motion to reconsider the vote. What's the correct motion?
Mr. Chair, I think it was the Senator Osmick's motion to amend Section 49, the oral amendment.
Okay. On the Schmidt motion to amend
reconsider the
vote whereby the Osmick motion passed on a 7-6 vote, the clerk will take the roll. The chair votes no.
Mr. Chair, this is a motion to reconsider?
Yes.
Senator Dibble.
Yes.
Senator Dietzick?
No.
Senator Herr?
This is to reconsider, yes. Mr. Chair. Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
No.
Senator Osmick?
No.
Senator Rood?
Yes.
Senator Sagsog?
No.
Senator Scalzi?
Yes.
Senator Schmidt?
Yes.
Senator Scoy?
No.
Senator Sparks? Senator Weber?
Yes.
Senator Westrom?
No.
Motion fails on a 6-7 vote.
All right.
Okay. On the bill, is there any other comments or questions on the bill? Seeing none, then Senator Schmidt moves that Senate File 2227, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further comments or questions or discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted. And I think this is going to be our last committee hearing for the year, but who knows what will happen when we come back from Easter break. So thank you, everybody. I appreciate everybody's help. The staff's been great, and you guys worked really hard.
It's been a great committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank
it's
you
been
very
a lot
much.
Fun.
I appreciate that. And
sure.
Yes, sir. Senator, oh, he said, wait, did he say you wanted to say
something?
No. Oh, thank you. All right, then meeting adjourned.